good to see everybody. I don't get up here on Wednesday night, and it seems fun sometimes. Maybe more fun than fellowship hall. I don't know. But anyway, so really, it's good to be here with you. As Dolores mentioned, this was supposed to be part two of two with our extreme adulting. We've rescheduled due to the flooding. That what was going to be part one to be the new part two, October 23rd. Tim Van Dyvendyke is a counselor, a chaplain. He's a wonderful therapist. And Jill Thompson, who is a physical therapist but works with folks with dementia a great deal. So don't miss that. Put that on your calendar and hope that you're here for that. This week, we have two of my friends and my lawyers, actually. So Glenn Eichelberger and Mary Mason, and they're here to talk to us about estate planning issues and other legal issues that I think are applicable to where we are in our lives. And so let me just kind of start. Glenn, tell us a little bit about yourself. Glenn, I've known forever. Basically, went to grew up at church and then in high school, and got to him really a lot better in college and since then, too. But you're in good hands tonight with Mary and Glenn. So, Glenn, just maybe tell a little bit about yourself and your family.
So, I grew up here in Houston, known Greg forever, and I went to Baylor University, as Greg did. And I worked for a few years as a CPA, and then I went to law school. And I've been out of law school for, shockingly, 26 years, all working in the area of estate planning and probate for my whole legal career. I'm married. I will celebrate with my wife our 25th wedding anniversary this coming year. We have one son who, sadly, when you marry an Aggie, there's a high probability of producing an Aggie. So my son is in his junior year at Texas A&M. I'm very happy about that. It's a great school. And I am, as is Mary, we're both board certified in estate planning and probate, which is a specialty area for our practice. And in fact, I sit on the exam commission for that exam and put the final touches on the question that I was responsible for writing for this year's exam this morning.
Nice.
Because they're about to take it in about a week.
So you grade their papers and stuff,
and
too?
And then we grade the papers.
Nice.
And then we deal...
Sick enjoyment of it.
Yes. So anyway.
Mary?
So I'm also a native Houstonian. I went to Texas A&M University, so I'm one of those Aggies, and then to South Texas for law school. I've been practicing in estate planning and probate for a little more than 19 years, which is a little hard to believe. I have a daughter who's 12. She's out at Fort Bend Christian in Sugarland, married for coming up on 13 years, board certified like Glenn in estate planning and probate.
Great. Well, let's kind of start, Glenn. Talk to us a little bit about kind of what those legal issues are that should be on our radar about where we are in life right now. I say we. I don't know if I'm a we, but...
Yeah, so the thing to be thinking about, not only for yourself, but also for the people that you're interfacing with in your family, whether it's children or potentially elderly parents, is do you have the legal documents that are necessary to handle kind of the situation depending on what the situation might be? So as a parent of young children, under the law, you of course have the right and duty to provide care and custody and food and clothing and shelter and all that stuff for your children, and you have the natural ability under the law to make a lot of decisions about your children, but depending on what you might have to do for them in terms of if they become the owner of assets and stuff, there may be some things to think about there. And then for yourself, certainly if you're the parent of young children, absolutely want to have an estate plan in place, because otherwise there are bad things that we'll talk about that could happen in terms of kind of asset management and stuff if something happens to you and your children are left without parents. And then, you know, for other members of your family, preparing for kind of, you know, elderly kind of issues, you know, dealing with parents and stuff like that.
Yeah. So. Well, talk to us a little bit, I guess, about the basics. The difference between passing away or your parents passing away with a will versus not having a will. How does Texas handle that in terms of probate law if you don't have a will?
Okay. So, and it doesn't matter if it's your parent passing away, if it's you passing away, whatever. I mean, the kind of threshold question is, well, what is mine in terms of assets that I need to be worried about, kind of how they pass? And so can we go to the kind of the next slide? So, you know, the kind of a threshold question, which to a lawyer in this area, it's really basic to ask, but it's something to remember. Texas is a community property state, so if you're married, the very first question is the asset that I'm thinking about, is it jointly owned with my spouse under the community property rules? Or is it my own separate property asset? Because an individual's estate plan only controls, if you're married and we're talking about a community asset, your will controls your half of the community, not your spouse's half, which seems kind of basic, but it's often a point of confusion. And then it also would control your separate property, but not your spouse's separate property. And so what is community property in Texas? Well, it's the first question to ask is, did you have a pre- or post-marital agreement before you got married? Because that could change the rules. But if you don't have one of those, the default rule is that basically community property is anything that has come to life, arisen, been earned, whatever, during marriage, will be community, meaning it'll be 50-50 owned by the spouses. And it, like, it's the result of wages, anything that comes because you earn dollars and all that. But it is not something that you brought to the marriage, as long as it hadn't been mixed with community property. And it's not anything that you inherit while you're married, as long as you don't mix it with other community property. But the big issue in Texas is that earnings on separate property are community property. That's not the way it is in other community property states, but that happens to be the Texas rule. So let's say one of the spouses has $500,000 of assets that they owned when they got married. Well, that $500,000, as long as they don't mix it with anything else with their spouse, and it's identifiable, the $500,000 remains their separate property, but every dollar it earns while they're married is a community asset. And so mayhem ensues when assets get mixed up that way. So the first question is, what are my assets? What are we talking about? What am I in? Go to the next slide. Okay, and so then the next question is, basically, if I'm talking about doing a will or I'm talking about doing an estate plan, what does my will even control? And people get confused on this. A will only controls probate assets because there are a whole bunch of assets that are non-probate and they're controlled in some other way besides whatever you write in your will. So if you'll go to the next slide, maybe the next slide too. Okay, so non-probate assets, which are increasing in number, honestly, in the modern world, are things like life insurance, because life insurance passes by beneficiary designation. So whoever you write on the beneficiary designation gets your life insurance. It's not passed under your will unless you want it to be and you make it to where the will controls the passage of life insurance. Usually people say, I'm leaving my life insurance policy to my husband or wife, or I'm leaving it to my brother or sister or my children or whatever. Well, that's who's going to get the life insurance proceeds, and whatever you say in your will has nothing to do with who gets the life insurance in that scenario. Another huge example that we run into all the time is you go down to XYZ Bank, you open up a bank account, and they put a bunch of papers that you don't even read because they're saying sign here, sign here, sign here. Mm-hmm. And the account that you have opened may well be what's called a JTWROS account. That stands for joint tenant with right of survivorship. That is the common default kind of account ownership. The fine print of that account says that whoever is the survivor, if there are two names on it, whoever's the survivor between the two gets the account automatically. It's not controlled by the will at all. So that's another non-probate asset. IRAs, 401ks have beneficiary designations, non-probate asset, not controlled by the will. POD account, that means pay on death, so that's a beneficiary designation account. So there are tons of assets that aren't even controlled by the will. Let's go to the next slide. So this is just making the point that we have to kind of combine the concepts of, if you're married, is it a community asset? It's only, then your will is only controlling your half of that asset. And then you also have to splice in the ideas of, is it even a probate asset to begin with? So it's a kind of an intersection of complicated things to decide what your will is going to control. I think maybe go one more slide. Okay, so the question Greg asked is kind of, so what does it look like if I have a will? Well, if you have a will, we'll talk about in a minute, you get to kind of decide what the rules are and where your assets go, assuming it's an asset that's controlled by your will. What happens if you don't have a will? So if you die without a will, Texas supplies a will for you. Every state in the United States supplies a will for a person who doesn't have one. It's called the intestacy laws. And people, a common misconception in Texas is, oh, well, my property is going to escheat to the state of Texas. That ain't going to happen. In law school, we are taught the phrase, Texas abhors escheat. In other words, the state of Texas is not in the business of trying to take your property from you. But what we do have is a complicated set of rules that say where your assets go. That's the intestacy laws. And guess what? The intestacy laws ask the questions, well, is it a community asset if you're married, or is it a separate property asset? And they ask the question, are you married? Do you have children? And all of those factors help figure out the rules of a particular asset. One surprising rule to people is in the state of Texas, if you don't have a will, the passage of community property between spouses, the surviving spouse only gets the assets if all the children are children of the same marriage. So if it's a second marriage situation, somebody had, you know, a child in by a first marriage, and then they remarry and they have, you know, children with the second spouse, all the children are not children of the marriage. Under that set of facts, the surviving spouse does not inherit the first spouse's community property. This can produce shocking results in mixed kind of, you know, marriages where there are children by more than one marriage. In fact, that was always the rule under Texas law for community property until 1993. In 93, because it had caused such kind of confusion, the rule was changed in 93 to where the intestacy law since 93 has said, if it's children or all of the marriage, then mom or dad will inherit all the community. So that was a big modernization in 93 of the Texas law on this. But anyway, so that's an example of one of the rules. And so like another one, separate property. So let's say, going back to my example, one of the spouses has $500,000 they brought to the marriage. If that spouse does not have a will and they die, that $500,000 account is going to be divided basically one-third to the spouse and two-thirds to the kids. And so the other issue that that produces is if the kids are minors, then the two-thirds of that $500,000 account, in my example, that's going to the kids, is going to necessitate the creation of a guardianship, because there's no other way to manage that two-thirds of the $500,000 account that minor kids have now inherited by default under the Texas rules.
That's a really big problem when it comes to a house, right? And that happens a lot, where you have somebody that dies without a will, and suddenly the surviving spouse ends up owning their home with the kids. And it's a problem, and it happens a lot.
Yeah, and so then there are all these issues about how you pay for the ad valorem property taxes and the maintenance and all this. There's all sorts of stuff that flows out of that.
You don't want to pass without a will.
It's a
big mess.
Yeah, well, I think, Glenn's kind of made clear what I was going to ask you next is, why do you need an estate plan? But it sounds like that is the better way to go. But kind of walk us through that a little bit.
Okay.
Why do we want an estate plan?
Okay, well, the biggest reason, as he just said, is then you get to choose who gets your assets. If you don't have a will, then the state of Texas is going to tell you who gets to take your stuff. Another reason would be, if you create a will, you have the opportunity to leave things to people in trust as opposed to outright. Leaving something in a trust has a lot of benefits. In larger estates, there are tax benefits to leaving the assets in that manner. Creditor protections, if you leave somebody an asset outright, just goes into their general pool of assets. They have an accident, they get sued, it exceeds the policy limits, and suddenly everything they inherited from you is taken in whatever judgment is against them. If it's in a trust, they don't technically own it. It's owned by a trustee, and then it's not reachable by that creditor. So that's a benefit that someone has to create for you. You can't create a trust for yourself, right? Otherwise, everyone would do that and get those protections, that is.
And in Texas, they also help with marital property characterization.
Yes.
For, children, like it's kind of a mini built-in sort of premarital for inherited assets that are held in trust as opposed to just held in the child's name. That
right.
Then the child gets married, and then there's more of a risk of commingling.
So they're not subject to division by divorce court because the person doesn't own them individually. The trustee owns them. And a lot of times that person will be the trustee, but still it's the law distinguishes it's you individually versus you wearing your trustee hat.
And even if we're not compelled by the tax reasons, the creditor protection, the marital property protection, for a young couple with children who are not adults, the trust is a necessity.
Yes.
To avoid the need to create a guardianship estate to manage assets that are left to a minor. So even if it's a relatively straightforward estate, we're going to create a trust in the will to avoid that guardianship problem.
And I think that kind of points out, and let's talk not so much about wills now as an estate plan. Maybe talk a little bit about sort of the components of an estate plan.
Okay, I think we have some slides on. Yeah, so the first thing would be a will. That's kind of the basic item. But then other important documents, and these are equally important, if not more so, right? And the first of those is a statutory durable power of attorney. And that may be the next thing on the next slide. I'm not sure if you want it. Yeah. And so that's a document where you name an agent to control financial matters on your behalf. It would be important to realize they can do anything that you can do if you grant them that power. They're useful if you make them to be effective immediately, because you don't have to prove to whoever you're trying to present the document to that the person is incapacitated. A lot of times you think somebody could only act on my behalf if I can't do it for myself. They're also useful for convenience. Married couples, for example, you have a piece of property for sale, someone's traveling for work, and the house is supposed to close. Well, the person who's the agent can go and take care of that transaction on behalf of the principal. They're also really useful when someone is incapacitated and they can't handle things for themselves anymore. It's a statutory form.
Because if you don't have one of these and somebody does become incapacitated,
you're
in an accident and you're in a coma and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
If you don't have somebody teed up under a power of attorney to handle your business, financial matters, move, your funds around, all that. The only other kind of option under Texas law is to go get a guardianship of some variety, so the guardian can access funds and pay bills and, you know, handle the financial matters, you know, take care of paying the mortgage on the house and, you know, whatever all needs to be done.
And that's expensive, and it's heavily court supervised, right? So everything you do has to go through a court, and that's not a situation that anyone wants to find themselves in. And this is a really easy document to get and to execute. So I think maybe that, yeah. So a medical power of attorney is kind of obvious, right? That's a document where you are naming an agent to make medical decisions for you, only if you're not able to communicate and make those decisions for yourself. That kind of goes along with the directive to physicians, which is a document where you can express in advance your feelings about life-sustaining treatment, right? It applies if you are in a, if you have a terminal or an irreversible condition, and then you're making a choice to say either do anything and everything possible to keep me alive or just keep me comfortable and let me go. And I always tell clients when we're in these meetings that some people don't want to put that burden on a spouse or family member having to be the one to decide whether somebody comes off of life support or they go on in the first place. And if you don't have this, then that's what happens, right? I think most people sign it. I can think of only a handful of times that people don't want to.
And right? I can only think of one client in 26 years who signed it and said, keep me alive at all costs.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Most people sign to say, keep me comfortable.
I can think of the guy who did that. And he's a tech guy, and he really believes in like cryogenics and blah, blah, blah.
Well, and it's good even just get these documents in place, but talk about them too.
Yes,
with your spouse or your family. I've been at the hospital in situations where a spouse has to make a decision and doesn't have any guidance other than sort of what the doctor is saying, sort of maybe what the pastor is saying. It if you know ahead of time, it makes such a big difference.
It makes it easier.
On the person.
That's right.
It's not just for you. It's really for your family.
Right. It really is more for the other people. And then the other is the HIPAA authorization, and that's a document where you're allowing the people that you list to have access to your medical records, and we usually would list the same people on that document that would be listing on the medical power of attorney, kind of for the obvious reasons they would have need to be able to see your medical records. I think the next slide may have a few. A designation of guardian. So this is kind of just a backup document, if you will, because if you've done a will and you've done the powers of attorney, then you've done everything really you can to avoid the need to be going down to a court to seek the appointment of a legal guardian. But if for some reason that should happen, this is a document where you're letting the court know, in this situation, this is who I would want to serve as the guardian of my person and the guardian of my estate. They generally will follow it unless there's some reason why that person is not suitable to serve. There's a similar document where parents can designate for their minor children at the death of the second who would take charge of the children while they're still minors.
Those are as fun conversations over the dinner table as well.
For a younger family that has minor children, that document is usually the holdup to the whole estate planning process. Because you have to get into these, should it be your parents or my parents or your sister or my brother and, you know, in what order and all that.
Are you saying that's separate? You have to have that separate from a will? Because can't you just have that in your
You family? Can have it in the will. It can be, it's got to separate. Be executed with the same formalities as a will. So mm-hmm. two witnesses and a notary.
So it used to be common, right? But we
it
don't
used
really
to be
do that
super
anymore.
Common to bury
document.
It in a will.
Yeah.
I haven't put it in a will in over 20 years because people change. But first of all, they can't find it in the will because the will's 30 pages long, and they're like, where's that paragraph? And then it gets changed all the time.
And it's harder
so
to change.
So it's harder to change the will. It's just more to think about.
Did you have
another
question?
So, like, with divorced parents,
I describe it as a jump ball. It's a jump ball like in basketball. Who dies second?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So then is there any way to have a conversation like then if the other parent dies after you, like where the kid or you, if you're,
well,
you're
it would,
dead,
it would work
you're
the same way, right?
Right?
It's just you can't designate somebody to take the children when you die if the other spouse, if the other parent is still living, right?
Right.
It only takes effect when there's no natural parent.
Yeah. If they're
left,
a surviving
you can't skip around
natural
them.
Parent, they win the
a lot of people probably like to. I think there may be a few more on the next. So just to make you aware of these documents, and out-of-hospital DNR, that's an option.
Which I would not normally do for anybody other than somebody, you know, maybe well advanced in years, let's say. I mean, that's somebody that, like, they're really close to the end of life, and they no. That document is for, I'm at home, and I collapse, and I'm 96 years old. I don't want to have 15 broken ribs with my chest being resuscitated and I'm ready to go. That's who needs that document.
There are some specific rules around that one, and I don't know all of them, but like being visible, like if an ambulance comes to the house, it has to be right there. They have to be able to find it or see it. Otherwise,
and there have to be you need to have multiple copies of it because you have to have one that travels with the patient at all times with the ambulance that's still going to take you to the hospital, even though they didn't resuscitate you. So there are rules.
Yeah. So the burial instructions or the appointment of an agent to control disposition of remains, that's an option. If you have specific wishes that you want carried out, this is a place to document them.
Or you think your family, your kind of closest kinfolk who would be left behind are going to get into a fight.
For where you go.
Mary had a situation 2 weeks ago where there was a serious disagreement over the body.
It really is sad. I'm laughing because I don't know what else to do. But in 19 years, I've never had that happen. And literally, it was the surviving spouse and the sister, and this poor man was dead. And they were fighting and had the hospital all up in arms about who gets to control the body, who gets to say where he goes, is he going to be cremated, is he not? It was awful. That was a first, and I hope it never happens again. But anyway. That
can I ask you a question about the will? What happens if you cannot find the original will?
So
the original PLA, and then all you have to copy.
Okay, well, so yeah, PLA.
This happened to us, right? It's happened to me. Glenn helped me with this.
You can donate a copy of a will if you can prove that that the original is not missing because the person destroyed it before they died. But it's pretty common. We do it a lot. So if you have a copy, usually we can make that work.
You have to overcome the presumption of revocation. But it's actually not that hard to do.
Right. And then the power of attorney copy, most people will take a copy. I don't think people generally ask for an original.
We had a Lady Bird Johnson. Lady Bird. We need an original power of attorney. We don't have it. We don't know where anything is.
Might need to do something about that. You don't want to,
Mary, I think we're kind of thinking, okay, well, it sounds like I need to do this, but maybe I'm a little intimidated. I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. Talk a little bit about that meeting with a client. If you say, hey, you know, whether it's you or somebody else says, I'd like to make an appointment. Tell us what that appointment is like, what you need to bring, what happens there.
So most of our initial client contact is through a phone call, right? That's how the process gets started. And that would be just kind of a general conversation to find out about the family and kind of generally what they're thinking they might want to do. And then we would set up a meeting. And in between the time of that call and that meeting, we have, and we brought some here, an estate planning questionnaire that we would ask you to fill out where it's family information, asset information, spaces for you to give ideas about who you might want to serve as executor or trustee, those kinds of things. That should come to the meeting with you.
That assets.
Right, and assets, I think, are on there. And then at that meeting, it's kind of a deeper dive into what you want to do and what some options are. If it's an estate that's of a size that tax concerns are important, then that would be part of the conversation. And it's also to see if there's a fit between the lawyer and the potential client, right? If we get a good vibe and it feels like everybody can work together. And It doesn't happen often, but sometimes we'll meet with people and then we don't end up doing the planning. And so in those cases, I mean, we don't charge for that, right? It's just to see if there's a fit. But it's, it's...
Yeah. When you do have an estate plan, with respect to the will in particular, and someone dies, does it always go through the court system? Does it always have to be probated? Or how does that work? What factors decide that?
I would hardly ever choose to decide not to probate a will. The reason is, in Texas, there's a four-year period during which you can get the will probated. And, after 26 years, I can't remember how many times I hear these sad stories about how we didn't realize that Aunt Bessie had left us. My mom, she died, and my mom got these minerals in such and such a, county or whatever, and mom's will didn't get probated, and it creates a mess, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, and probate in Texas is really straightforward. Back to the frontier days, as I say, Texas set up what's called an independent administration process, so we can have an independent executor. That means once appointed by the court literally doesn't have jurisdiction to supervise the day-to-day actions and activities of the executor. That is very different than other states. That's why in some states, like New York and California, everybody runs in mortal fear of having to go through probate. In Texas, we kind of don't really worry about probate because it's a three-minute hearing.
One court appearance.
Then there's some responsibility, there's some filings that we have to do, like publish notice to creditors and provide notice to beneficiaries. But that's stuff that the lawyer's office is driving on behalf of the executor. And the court isn't there demanding, information about what's happening or granting the power to do stuff as long as we're administering, a will that has, the right kind of provisions in it. So basically the answer is pretty much every will is probated because the risk of not doing it during the period, to me is more significant than just going ahead and doing it so we know we're covered. And we know if mom's will gets probated, we know that we can control the passage of assets, and even 20 years later, if we find out about Great Aunt Bessie's minerals, we generally don't ever close an administration in Texas, so then all we have to do is go order a fresh letter testamentary for our executor, and the executor can get Great Aunt Bessie's minerals or whatever, and sign leases and do all sorts of things.
So do you feel like... Do you need a lawyer to do that, to do all this, if it's a simple estate?
Yes.
Yeah.
You can't represent yourself in a fiduciary capacity, so that is, you couldn't do it pro se, meaning without a lawyer.
Yeah. Now, if say a parent dies without a will, what do you do? What if you're the surviving child or a surviving child? What should you do?
It's kind of the same process, right? You're filing an application with the court, but this time you're filing an application to have the court determine who are the heirs of the estate, and you're filing a separate application to have someone appointed as the administrator of the estate that will collect the assets, pay the debts, and then pass the property out to the heirs. Generally, you're still able to do it independent of court supervision if all of the heirs agree that can happen. Sometimes that can be difficult, like one that we have right now. One of the heirs was a minor child, and it was her mother who was seeking to be appointed as the independent administrator, and the court wouldn't allow it, right? They wouldn't allow her to act independent of court control, so it had to be a dependent administration, which another good reason to have a will, because it's expensive, it's cumbersome, everything you want to do, you have to apply to the court.
But we've done that. We've gotten the court to appoint a surviving parent.
In certain courts, but because I know the one you're thinking of, but it doesn't
we've
happen.
We've been successful
we
on
have,
that.
But now we have four new probate judges, so who knows? But the one I'm looking at yesterday, right, with a minor child, and the court said, no, I'm not going to do it. The mom, right.
And in order to figure out who the heirs are, yeah, so there's that, you know, we looked at that slide early on about kind of you have to know whether it's separate or community property and what the family pattern is. In order to prove who the people are that could take the property, it takes two disinterested witnesses.
And another lawyer, right?
And another lawyer.
Forget that.
The witnesses have to be familiar with the family history, so they have to say, you know, I know that, you know, Greg was married and they had two children and, you know, this, that, and the other, and, you know, those witnesses are interviewed. A third-party lawyer is appointed. That lawyer talks to the witnesses, and all that happens before we can ever go have a hearing. And then everybody goes down to the hearing.
Yeah, it's
so it's
to be avoided.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, and Glenn. I know as your parents got older, you cared for your parents. Is there anything that's sort of a quasi-legal question, I guess, but anything surprised you in caring for your parents and handling their finances and that sort of thing in that during that season?
Well, it didn't go on for me as long as it went on for you. but you know, it's just a lot of responsibility taking care of kind of everything for an elderly parent. You know, for me, it went on kind of effectively for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years or something like that. And just the weight of dealing with just the mechanics of it. And I'm an estate planning lawyer. My mom had, and my dad had a good estate plan. And so we had all the documents we needed, but still, it's still a lot of work. And the other thing is, depending on kind of what happens, what the illness is, how long it lasts, the care that's needed, it's an extremely expensive thing. And so, you know, making sure to the best of anybody's ability that, you know, that's been anticipated and planned for. I mean, we live in a society that's just so different than the way families lived 100 years ago, where elderly, you know, grandma and grandpa would be living with couple generations of the family. That's not necessarily how it's going to happen, you know, nowadays, but it's, I don't know, it's expensive, it's stressful, especially if you're a sandwich generation person. You know, you've got children you're taking care of, you're working, and you're taking care of your elderly parents too.
Yeah, save some capacity for that, because that's coming. Mary, what are some obstacles? I know you've helped people in this situation too, caring for their parents and looking ahead, estate planning. What are some obstacles that you see families deal with, and maybe some clashing points based on your experience?
One of the biggest things would be just not having a plan that's in place, right? And then something goes wrong and there are no documents, and so who's in charge? People disagree about what should happen. And you can avoid that if you've done these documents and you've designated who that person is going to be. What are some good ones that we that could be an example of what not to do?
I mean, one of the big challenges sometimes is there's not, like, good people kind of in the picture. So, you know, if it's an elderly person and maybe
family lives away.
Or you know, they're kind of issues with various family members. There's really no one to step in. That's a huge thing that's really hard to deal with. And there are not any really easy, good answers to that. And then, you know, one thing we observe from time to time is people, in some families, people think it's a real kind of prize to be grasp onto, to be the one who mom appoints as the power of attorney holder, or, you know, dad is appointed as the executor under the will. And if you meet with somebody who is the one who's appointed, and they think that this is a real prize that they've won, that, you know, they're very special, and so they get to control everything, that's a sign that things are not good things are going to happen. Because anybody who's served in that position knows it's an extremely taxing thing to be the one, and it is not a position of kind of, you know, power to be wielded. It's a position with real responsibility and kind of lots of difficulty.
Yeah, and you talk to your siblings about things like this. I know it's kind of an awkward conversation, but again, the more you plan and almost normalize a conversation, the more you're going to hopefully get along. And it's also always surprising. I hear, you know, stories about it, even, you know, with my family who get along really well. There's some issues, so talk about it beforehand and try to normalize it.
Yeah, the only winners in the siblings are at each other's throat about mom and dad's stuff are the lawyers.
Yeah.
The lawyers are the only people who win. We win because we get bigger fees.
It's just sad, right? It brings such ugliness and animosity, and it's a nasty.
Yeah,
and people get ugly. I mean, you would be surprised.
My brother and I get along great. We never had any issue. It all went completely smoothly. Mary handled my mother's estate. And my brother and I, you know, I just deferred to her, and he deferred to me and to her, and we never had any issue whatsoever. That's the way it really should be.